This is the Hockey News Podcast.
Hello, hockey fans, and welcome to the Hockey News Podcast. I'm your host, Edward Fraser, here with Ryan Kennedy and Matt Larkin. Ken Campbell is in Vegas covering the Cup. No, I guess he's in
Washington. Well, now he's in D.C., yeah. He's
in Washington at this point. Gentlemen, the Cup has gone, I think, a little pear-shaped compared to what some people thought, at least compared to what I thought. I want to know at this point, have your picks or your thoughts about how long this series is going to go changed based on what's happened so far?
It's interesting. I mean, I picked Vegas to win the series in seven games. So, I mean, I'm going to stick with that because it has to be 2-1 at some point. Or, you know, it's going to be a close series if it's going to go seven games.
It could
games.
Be 3-0.
Yeah,
that's
it could
true.
Be. Yeah, that's right.
Doesn't have to be
2-1.
Damn.
Math!
Damn it! Damn math! Stupid math! But admittedly, my confidence is wavering a little bit because I think that, I mean, we said going into the series, it's two contrasting styles, and I think Washington's doing a better job imposing its style than Vegas is. I think it's becoming more of an ugly, grinding series, and also Washington's star power is shining through. Guys like Kuznetsov, Ovechkin are stepping it up, and that was always an advantage. So the two advantages that Washington had on paper, I thought, were brute force and star power, are shining through. So it's just a matter of, can Vegas counterpunch now and get that home crowd when the series shifts back and get the home crowd back into it, get the speed game going, turn the legs. And I really do think that Tom Wilson early in the series had an impact and sort of goaded Vegas into starting to play the ugly game. And yes, Vegas, you know, has some guys that can mix it up, Alex Tuck and Derek Engel and stuff. Yeah, Ryan Reeves. But I think compared to what Washington can counter with, they can't play that style and expect to keep alive in the series for very long.
I think we're going to see adjustments, no doubt, and how well Vegas can play in what I will call a half-court setting, I think will be the big thing. When Washington took game two, it seemed to me at least, they did a great job of establishing offensive zone presence and nullifying Vegas' speed advantage, because when the Golden Knights are moving, they're always moving, and it's very hard to get a beat on them, whether it's offensively or defensively. But when Washington was able to establish things, and obviously on the power play, they were very good at it, but when the Knights had to stop, they looked a little lost. It's something that just hasn't happened to them this year because they've been so good at their game plan. I think we're going to see Vegas make an adjustment where they're going to win at least one more game in this series. I have no doubt about that. My original prediction was Washington in six, so I'm feeling pretty happy about that right now because it's looking pretty nice in that direction. And again, it's only 2-1. A lot can happen, but I think, as Matt said, there are a lot of positives going Washington's way. And the team that just felt like it's funny, both teams had chips on their shoulders in terms of nobody believed in us. When it came to Vegas and with Washington, it was like, we are not chokers, stop calling us chokers. I feel like Washington, they've really seized that mantle, and that energy is really helping them. You can see it in all their players. And so for me, I'm sticking with Washington in six.
I had Vegas in five, so minus a time machine.
It's not looking too good.
I got a couple questions about Vegas, so I'll pose one to each of you. Can Vegas alter its style to play this half-court game that you pointed out? Because this has become a cycle series. It's not a wide-open series that we thought. I mean, it has been at times, but for the most part, this has been locked down. Vegas hasn't faced an opponent like this in the playoffs so far. They haven't particularly adjusted well. Game one was a different beast, but if Washington continues to do what they do, if Vegas scores first, I think it becomes maybe a different style of game, but I mean, that's really changing your core of who you are. Can Vegas win if it becomes a cycle game?
I say no, and personally, I mean, I ain't no coach, but I'm not a fan of changing your style to meet the other team's style, because that's what the other team is trying to get you to do. It reminds me a lot of the Toronto-Boston series, where the Leafs were struggling when they fell behind the series because they were playing a cycle game and they're a speed team, and once they just decided to go back to the Cowboy style, they got Boston back on their heels, they created chaos, and they got back in that series. So for me, if I'm Vegas, I'm not trying to slow the game down. I'm going to keep trying to push my style on Washington, find a way, whether it's stretch passes or take some gambles. And like you said, at scoring first, if Vegas can score first, which requires aggression and playing with speed, then it forces Washington to play catch up, and Washington has to start playing more of a speed game.
I'm guessing, I'm just saying, like, if Washington gets ahead again, which has been the MO, like, can Vegas alter its style to get back into games? Because once Washington falls back into that diamond or the 1-4 or whatever you want to call that system that they play when they get up, and they do it with, you know, great effectiveness. Mm-hmm. I just don't see Vegas being able, they haven't had any sustained zone time
right.
in this series. They've never really shown that they can be threatening when they get down a couple.
Because they're not grinders, right? They're not
exactly.
a team of big,
yes.
they're not a team of Jay Beagles and Lars Eller's, like
yes.
Tom Wilson, Devontae Smith-Pelly. Those guys are heavy,
yes.
right? And that's not Vegas' game, so I agree. No. If Vegas is forced to keep playing that style, Washington's going to win the cup.
Ryan, is Vegas for the first time, because they've had a lot of success, and I think a large part of this is because they've been able to play pressure-free. They've been able to play loosey-goosey. Is this the first time where they're going to face some adversity, and what impact does that have? Because this is... they've always, you know, the expectations have been so low so far, but
yeah.
it's a different beast when the cup comes. And I know Ken Campbell, who's covered umpteen cups, has talked about this. You hit the reset button when you hit the Stanley Cup because everything's different, the expectations are different. So does Vegas, is this a different thing that they've never faced before, and what's the impact of that?
Well, it is, and it's tricky because you can't play the nobody believed in us card when you're in the Stanley Cup final. Mm, like, you can't say, like, oh, we're the underdogs here. It's like, well, you have home ice advantage in
and
the Stanley Cup final,
yeah,
and you're the
yeah,
favorite in going
yeah.
in. So it can mess with your mind. And I think that it's tricky adversity because when you came in with the first round, it was like, ah, happy to be here. Let's, you know, we're here to win. But I think for outsiders, we thought, well, you know, this is a nice little story for Vegas. But the Kings, they're pretty battle-tested. They passed that. With San Jose, I thought Vegas would win. But, you know, the Sharks are still a pretty good outfit. And then when you get to playing Winnipeg, I think all of us thought that whoever won the Winnipeg-Nashville series would take the West. So, again, Vegas was an underdog in terms of narrative, if not in terms of, you know, the standings and whatnot. Now it's a matter of, well, you're playing a team that's never won a Stanley Cup either and has a history of having trouble and has never been this far either in this era. So for Vegas, I think that they have to admit to themselves, like, yeah, we're a really good hockey club. We're playing another really good hockey club. Things are pretty much even in terms of narratives.
Is tonight a must-win for Vegas?
I mean, I believe in the Pat Burns theory that game four is huge. And absolutely, because it's the momentum is everything. If Vegas wins this game, and apologies for anyone who's listened to, who's already seen the game, if you're listening to Tuesday.
Yeah. Spoiler alert.
But if Vegas wins game four, it's like, oh, wait, now it's 2-2. Home ice advantage is back. We're going back to Vegas. Yes. And then a huge pressure falls on Washington.
Yeah.
Right? So that would change the series completely, even the style of play. I think Vegas would get its confidence back. But it is interesting, and I agree with Ryan. I mean, the thing about Vegas is they've been this cute, fun, cuddly story. But when you get so close to completing the story, then suddenly it's like, oh, man, if we come this far, no one expected this. And it's so fun and almost funny that Vegas could win the cup. But oh, what if we don't win it now? What if we get this close, but then we don't finish that story? And then suddenly we're kind of forgotten years from now because we didn't finish the job. Now that we're here, I do think that there's a new pressure that has emerged for Vegas. Absolutely.
And I think in a funny way, even if Washington wins tonight, I don't think the series is over because I think that pressure to close the job
right.
then starts to fall on Washington. And especially then if they lose game five in Vegas, which would be the expectation going back home, even though they were already able to win there already, that becomes a new type of pressure to win that game six on your home ice. Because
right.
if you got to go back to Vegas in seven,
right.
then that pressure is really
heavy. Well, think about all the Ovechkin on the precipice pieces that will be published in newspapers across the country, right? If they're one win away, whoo.
Another huge topic, as it unfortunately has been throughout this NHL season, concussions, headshots. Brooks Orpik, Marc-Andre Fleury, both suffered or appeared to get into situations where perhaps they should have gone to the quiet room. That was talked about quite a bit. Matt, you've been on this beat for a long time. You've had concussion issues yourself, so you're very sensitive to the issue. Should these guys have been sent to the quiet room?
Absolutely, and I think there's two problems. One, there's this huge stigma apparently with sending your goalie to the quiet room, because goalie, unlike a defenseman, like Brooks Orpik is going to come off the ice at the end of his shift. But I think that the spotters are afraid to ever send a goalie to the quiet room, because if you're in the middle of a playoff game, you're going to disrupt momentum. You have to bring in the backup goaltender in the middle of a game cold. And what if he gets scored on right away? I think there's crazy pressure to not send a goalie. So that we got to find a way for the spotters to just mentally overcome that pressure. And with Orpik, that one really upset me, because there's
that was crazy.
You saw Orpik's, like, if you're not making the call on that, then what are you looking for?
Sure.
Orpik went down, and to me it was even more troubling.
And he has a history of concussion.
Yeah. He's been banged up in these playoffs even, and the fact that if I remember correctly, he didn't even take the shot to his head. When you take a shot to your chest and you go down hard and you're still that woozy, to me that's even a worse sign, because I think people are finally starting to understand that helmets and direct blows to the head aren't always the cause of a concussion. It's the whipping motion.
Absolutely.
And especially we saw that with a lot of Eric Lindros' concussions back in the day. I don't think there was a single one that where he took an actual shot directly to his jaw. It was always his head whipping and his body hitting the ice. We saw that with Orpik. So I just don't understand to me, Orpik's behavior after that hit was so textbook, it could be used in an instructional video for spotters. So if you're not using that as your template for what to make the call for, then why do we even have spotters?
That was my next question is, you know, if the spotters aren't doing this, is this just paying lip service, so to speak, to the concussion issue?
Yeah. And what bothered me is that, you know, after it happened, Orpik was gesturing to one of the refs on the bench saying, like, that, you know, that was a headshot. And it's like, okay, wait. So you don't want to miss time, but you think there should have been a penalty. So you say it's a headshot, but it should only be a penalty on Tom Wilson. It should not be you in the quiet room. And I think that's the fundamental flaw with the entire system, is that players want to be safe, but it seems they don't want to be too safe.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like, we want to be safe, but not if it takes me out of the game.
You have to save the players from themselves.
And that was the whole point of the spotters in the first place, is take it out of their hands. And we saw it with James Neal earlier in the series, where he was basically shaking off the trainer like he was calling a curveball, and Neal wanted to throw the heat. He's like, no, I'm not going anywhere. No, not again. I already went. I'm not going again. It's like, well, we're not doing this because we hate you.
Yeah, of course.
Especially when it's
we're
the trainer on your own team.
You,
yeah, the trainer wants to win the Stanley Cup too, and you're shaking him off. The whole point of the spotters was to eliminate this sort of gray area, and clearly it hasn't done that.
So, I mean, is this just as simple as erring on the side of caution? And in every situation, you just take the guy back. I mean, because, you know, I don't pretend to go know what goes on in those quiet rooms, but I'm guessing if there isn't a situation where there should be concern, they can get them out of there fairly quickly.
You could call a timeout, even if it's your goalie. You say, if you haven't used your timeout, you could use it
to
start.
Yeah. Never leave your timeout. But, is this just, should we just be sending everybody in any situation? I mean, that to me seems like it's the most sense. If you're at all think that there's a possibility that this guy suffered a concussion, let's get him back there.
I think absolutely. And I think one thing, I mean, I think I just thought of this idea on the spot right now. This is not prepared. But, like, what if you made a rule? Because I think the goaltender thing is a problem, because spotters are going to be hesitant because the goaltender coming off really disrupts the game.
Absolutely.
Versus a player who's going to come off anyways after every shift. What if there's a mandatory timeout that doesn't count as your team's timeout? If a goalie's ever sent off the ice, the game pauses for 5 minutes to make sure the goalie's okay. And then he can come back and maybe he doesn't miss any of the game.
Sure, and then, you basically, I don't know if you can actually put it on a physical clock or anything like that. I don't know how long it takes to... But yeah, I mean, there's something fair like that. But you're at the same time, like, your backup goalie is there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
So be ready.
Yeah.
Be ready.
Yeah. If he strained his groin, it's the same thing.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It's an injury. So, right. I mean, if your backup goalie, if you can't depend on him, you haven't done a good job as a team manager to have a backup goaltender who can come in and save your team.
If your goalie cramped up and had to come out in the middle of a game, you got to put your backup in.
It's exactly. I mean, that to me is something that I've really changed my mind on in the past decade or so, is that head injuries, they're injuries. It's no different from a broken leg or a sprained shoulder or a cut. It's just not as easily detectable.
Right.
But you have to treat it in the same fashion. You'd never send a guy out on a busted ankle.
Right?
Skate it off.
Well,
you're fine.
It's so true. And it's interesting because the very fact that we have to have spotters illustrates the problem, that players especially don't take the head injury seriously. Like, we don't have groin injury spotters. Hey, that guy strained his groin. Totally. I'm making a call. Yeah. Because no players would argue that. A guy blows at his knee. He understands it's a real injury. He's not even going to put up a fight. The trainer's going to come and help him off the ice. Whereas the head injury, it's like the fact that we need a babysitter to make a call just to say, hey, that guy's trying to play even though I can see from here that he's showing symptoms of an injury. That, to me, shows the problem with how players in particular perceive a concussion versus another injury.
And it's so much more integral to get these things dealt with immediately because of second impact syndrome and the long-term effect of these. I mean, you break an ankle or whatever, you can play through another injury and there's probably not going to be any long-term damage. Some will. I mean, you know, you get a hip replacement, get a knee replacement, you know, whatever. Mm. But, I mean, when you're dealing with your head and story after story after story, I mean, you've got to save these guys from themselves. Yeah. You have to. It's your responsibility. So to me, it's the error. You have to err on the side of caution with these guys.
Yeah,
so.
I agree. And that's the tough part is that in this case, we're all preaching to the choir. It's just a matter of... And it's tough because these spotters, like, they have so much responsibility placed on their shoulders because in the players' minds, it's like the spotters are creating an injury. Whereas spotters are saying, no, that is an injury. We're just identifying it.
Sure.
Mm. Right? But there's a perception that it's the spotter's fault for... I'm doing air quotes again, for stopping the game. But no, it's the injury's fault, not the spotter's fault.
Yeah. John Carlson was set to get paid this summer no matter what. The guy led the league in scoring from defensemen. He's clearly the best UFA defenseman in what is a fairly thin... And fairly might put... You might use your air quotes around that one, too. But has he raised his stock even more in these playoffs? I mean, what is the limit for that some team is going to pay this guy? And a follow-up question to that, is there any way Washington can keep him?
I don't think there's any way they can keep him because you have other players you need to sign. Mm-hmm. And the cap's not going up that much, it seems, because I think John Carlson... Well, there's two scenarios here. If Washington wins the cup, then he definitely doesn't come back because it's like mission accomplished. Sure. Let's go get paid. If they don't win the cup, then maybe they can say to him, hey, we're so close, you know, let's try one more time. But that I feel that's fraught with peril. when I'm looking at Carlson right now, I'm seeing a player that could ask for 7 years on the open market, clearly, ask for the max, maybe eight.
Oh, yeah.
Why not?
Sure.
Eight times seven.
Yeah.
Eight times seven. That's like, you know, if somebody wants to go above and beyond that in order to secure his rights, I could certainly see that too. But I think you're looking at a player that has established himself as one of the best in the NHL, and he's still got a lot of good hockey ahead of him. And he's not a player that exclusively relies on, like, his wheels, for example. So it's not a skill set that's going to necessarily diminish quickly. Sky's the limit.
I only wonder if, I mean, you know, I think winning is a paramount for many players, but if there was a team that has a lot of cap space that maybe isn't a contender at this point who has that room, because, I mean, could he get nine and a half?
Yeah, if, like, you get a single.
Crazy. Like,
yeah. I personally don't agree, though. I think the Washington Capitals are going to re-sign him. Because the cap's going up to between 78 and 82 million. So that's going to automatically give at least 3 million more to play with in cap space. Your RFAs are Tom Wilson and Philip Grubauer. So it's not like either guy's going to be getting $7 million. Wilson's earned a nice raise for sure. He's earned a long-term deal. But it's not like Wilson is a 30-goal scorer. I think Wilson, a big raise could be $3 million, $4 million. To me, Grubauer is a trade candidate. And then you got Jay Beagle, who's a checking center, who's a UFA. But none of those guys are bigger priorities than Carlson.
Right.
And the Capitals, Brian McClellan, their GM, has already been open about the fact that they're going to do everything they can. And I think that is a guy that you move other things around to prioritize, right? So I think the money will be tight, but I think the Capitals are going to be in the game. And again, when things are close, and, you know, if you're John Carlson, it's like, okay, you could get $8.5 million for 7 years, or you could get $8 million for 8 years and your two kids don't have to move and your wife doesn't have to move and you're where you've always played your whole career. I think that comfort does matter as a tiebreaker when things are close. But that said, I agree that winning the cup is interesting because then it's like you've accomplished that bucket list item and then it's a matter of just where you think you'll have the most fun playing.
Yeah, and my worry with re-signing him is not so much do they have the specific room right now, but do you then become too top-heavy because you've already got Ovechkin, the Oshie deal, you know, you've got Holby, like you've got a lot of big money players already. Mm-hmm. They're already like not the best in terms of depth on defense. I mean, Michael Kempney has had a pretty decent run, and that was sort of found money because they got him off the Hawks at the deadline. But can you pull that rabbit out of the hat again next year if you had to? I'm not sure if they can because they don't have the system to back it up.
Yeah, and I just wonder, like, again, playing off your point, is do you want to be top-heavy? Do you want to be the Chicago Blackhawks?
I mean, I think you do. And the Pittsburgh Penguins. Like, those are the teams that win cups these days.
But no, but Chicago wasn't extremely top-heavy until the past couple of years. And we all know they haven't won a playoff game since the Kane and Taves extensions kicked in.
Yeah.
Mm. So do you want to be crazy top-heavy, or do you want to be Vegas?
Yeah, it's a great philosophical question. Yeah. I mean, I'm still personally a fan of the top-heavy model. At least, I mean, it burns out your team eventually,
sure,
of course, but it gets you cups along the way, right? So,
yeah.
And here Vegas is, they're not a deep team, but here they are in the Stanley Cup Final.
I think they're proving that you don't.
Or Washington, sorry.
Washington, yeah. Yes, but Vegas is there too. So I mean, I think you can think about it in two ways. There's going to be two different approaches, and I wonder, especially if Vegas win this thing, is that going to be one of the copycat effects? Are we going to see teams played a little more safe and spread their money around a little bit more?
Well, what's interesting about Vegas is, you know, William Karlsson, breakout year, no doubt about it. Is he intrinsically a legit number one center in the sense of a Jonathan Toews, a Sidney Crosby, and Andre Kopitar? Because, I mean, this year he has obviously played to that level in a very small sample size, but like we have not had a Stanley Cup winner without that dominant number one center in like the lockout era, like since the lockout. So if Vegas should win, does a team like Montreal or Carolina that lacks that number one center say, well, Vegas did it, and you know, like we don't expect William Karlsson to score 40 goals next year, maybe he scores 30, mm-hmm. but they did it, so maybe we don't need to have a number one center as long as we have essentially 12 interchangeable forwards that are all pretty good and buy into a plan. Mm-hmm. That to me is very fascinating. Now, if you just think that William Karlsson's a number one center and he just happened to come out this year and establish himself as that, then it reverts back to the Kopitars, the Bergerons, the Crosbys, and whatnot. But I think that's kind of a fascinating question to look at in this final.
Ryan, you were at the dog and pony show that is the NHL Draft Combine this weekend. Any thoughts coming out of that?
Well, I think the big storyline is Jesperi Kotkaniemi, who...
Say that three times fast. Yeah.
Indeed. The Montreal media were flocking around him because there's a lot of speculation that the Habs could take him. Now, do they take him with the third pick overall, or do they trade down and get him, you know, somewhere in the 9-10 range? It's very interesting because, you know, we had him 18th in draft preview, and the knock on him was his skating. It is improving. He got better as the season went along. He's got a lot of great assets. He's got size. He's got skill. He's played well internationally. Didn't play center domestically in Finland. Only played center against his age group when he played internationally for Finland and did pretty well there. But I think he's the most fascinating player in the first round right now because if a team believes he can be a number one center, then he's going to go very high. Mm. If they don't, then obviously he slides down a bit. But in a year that we don't have a surefire pivot, we don't have a McDavid, we don't have an Auston Matthews, if you're a team that needs a center, are you reaching? Are you trading back and hoping that Kotkaniemi or Joe Valeno or Barrett Hayton turns into that player? That, to me, is a very fun storyline.
Do you suspect that you'll see some... I mean, it doesn't happen very frequently in the NHL, not compared to the way it does in the NFL, which I think are the two most comparable drafts.
Mm-hmm.
Do you suspect we'll see more trading down this year, because if you've got a certain guy in mind and you can get a little, you can get a second or a third, mm-hmm. you know that guy's going to be available. You're not crazy about what's going on top, because there's a lot of question marks. There's a lot of talent up there, but there's a lot of question marks.
Certainly.
Is there going to be more wheeling and dealing of picks, more pivoting of positioning in this year's draft?
I feel there could be because you do have a lot of mobile defensemen, and if you're a team that misses out on, say, Adam Boqvist, mm-hmm. Quinn Hughes is still there. You go a little further, Ty Smith is still there. You go a little further, are you willing to take a chance on Ryan Merkley, who is a great offensive defenseman, lacks on the defensive end, needs to mature a bit, but does know it. You can trade down and you can still get some pretty nice skill and maybe pick up some other assets. There's also teams, like I said, if you're looking for a number one center and you don't think you can find it, then maybe you go a different direction. If Montreal's not super keen on Philip Zadina or Brady Tkachuk, and they think there's somebody like Hakaniemi that they could get a little later on, then maybe you do trade down, and maybe there's a team like the Rangers that wants to trade up because maybe they like Brady Tkachuk a lot. They just brought in his coach from BU. So I think there could be movement. I know Carolina's been pretty open about listening to offers, and a lot of teams say that, but you never know. They got new ownership. I think this is a year where we could see a lot of jockeying for position.
I'm looking at Detroit as well, by the way, and I think it was a Craig Cousins piece that was reporting it, but Ken Holland was talking about trading down, and Detroit's a prototypical example. We know that they want a center or defenseman, but at the top part of the draft, like near where Detroit's picking, right above them, the tier above, there's wingers, right? I mean, after Rasmus Dahlin, it's Philip Zadina, it's Andrei Svechnikov, and it's Brady Tkachuk. So they're not looking for wingers. So if they're going to get a defenseman in that tier of Hughes and Bouchard, and there's Noah Dobson as well, and Boqvist as well, then it's like, well, if you feel like you're getting the same value five picks lower, you may as well trade down and net another asset.
Matt, I want to ask you this, and Ryan, you can chime in after if you want to, is you hear a guy like Hakaniemi who has skating issues. Okay, in today's NHL, speed kills. I don't think it's ever been more important. If you hear a guy has speed issues, yes, we've learned that guys can improve their skating, but is that almost a non-starter now? I mean, especially in a first-round pick, you're a trade guy you're trying to develop into your number one center.
Yeah, I think it's fair because, you know, there are the success stories like John Tavares and Mark Stone, but they're the exceptions. The rule, the more common stories are the Strome family.
Yeah.
I was going to say all the Stromes, right? And it's interesting because with Dylan Strome, it's like we knew that was the knock on him in his draft year, and it's kind of scary. It's like, well, the knock on him, what a shocker, continued to be the knock on him and is still the knock on him, right? So I think when you're especially picking high in the draft, you don't want to be grabbing a guy who has very obvious warts, especially when, like you said, speed is so important.
Right? To me, speed is the biggest, or a lack of speed is the biggest wart in today's game, because you can teach to a degree, you can teach to a degree so many other skills, but speed is, to me, the toughest one to rectify.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a gamble whether you can ever do it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And today, and you talk about the copycat effect of Vegas. To me, there will be no bigger aftershock of what's come out of Vegas is the speed thing. To me, it's just reaffirmed how important speed is in today's game.
And Pittsburgh too, right? So it started with Pittsburgh and it's continuing through. Yeah.
And I think, you know, he might turn out to be a very good player. I'm just wondering about when he goes. And I look back last year at Gabe Vilardi, who I think we had him number 3 in draft preview, but he fell to the Kings and it was double digits.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, he looked good this year. He's not slow, but he's not fast. He was a good puck protection guy. But those kind of slides can happen. So will it happen with Kotkaniemi? Possibly. But like I said, I think he's kind of the most fascinating to watch in terms of slot.
Even more interesting than Ryan Merkley? Because the draft preview said Ryan Merkley was
Ryan Merkley is like the most controversial.
Okay.
And I think Kotkaniemi now, because there's so much buzz around him in Montreal...
Yeah.
That kind of supersedes it. Where with Merkley, like, we know what he is. It's just a matter of who's going to take a chance on him and when.
We're moving into reader questions. Still need that jingle.
Oh, reader questions.
We've got reader questions. We're going to stay on the draft side of things. Zach Eilers, sorry if I'm butchering that, asks, aside from Dahlin, which prospects from this year's draft do you see making their NHL teams right away, Ryan?
Well, I think Andrei Svechnikov, pretty obvious. Philip Zadina, I think Brady Tkachuk might not go straight to the NHL. Mm-hmm. He could go to the AHL first. And then the other player would be Evan Bouchard. You know, he's a 1999 birthday, a late birthday, or early, as Matt likes to say. But he's got the makeup and he's got the size that he could help a team right away. And I was talking to a scout this year about OHL prospects, and he said, you know, other than Svechnikov, Bouchard's probably the most likely to go straight to the NHL, even though he's a defenseman.
Sure.
So I would start with those guys, and you know, from there, I think things get like a little more messy. There's always one player you don't expect, but those to me are the guys I would expect.
Out of Zadina and Svechnikov, should they be in the NHL next year? Like, is there, for a development curve, is this their next best step?
I think so.
I
think, you know, Svechnikov, even though he was injured for part of the season, I mean, he just burned through the OHL. I mean, he's almost a goal per game guy.
Yeah.
With Zadina, we've seen him play at the World Juniors and succeed, even though he was an underager there. And we saw him torch the Quebec League. And, you know, he's a player with a good motor, and he is a natural goal scorer. So I think because they're wingers, they also come in with less responsibility than if they had been a center.
Yeah,
and that's a bonus as well. So I think both of them should be fine because they've got all the high-end elements.
Are these guys who would benefit from either a full or partial season in the AHL? Because, I mean, their eligibility means it's junior or the NHL.
Exactly. So. I think that that should be an option. I've been a longtime proponent of that. Unfortunately, it's not the rule. Unless they were loaned out by their original European franchises, I call it the Julius Honka rule. Or I guess it's Julius Honka because he's Finnish. So you do see that sometimes. Alex Nylander is another one where he went to the AHL as a teenager, even though he had played for Mississauga the year before.
And he was never heard from again.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, I would like to see it because then you are playing against men once again. And if you don't think the player's ready, then the AHL's perfect. But that's the system we have.
I really like Zadina in particular. I mean, it's not a big statement to say I like Zadina, but to me, his game reminds me of Marian Hossa. Like, he's got the natural goal scoring ability, but I think Zadina has the ceiling to become a really good two-way forward as well because he's got the good motor and he seems like he's super coachable, at least from what I've understood, scouting reports I've read on him and stuff like that. So to me, he not only can jump right in, but I see him being a guy that makes a really big impact and plays a lot of minutes compared to your average rookie. And I'm looking at the Carolina Hurricanes for him because his world junior center happens to be last year's first-round pick, Marty Necas, that guy.
Yeah.
Right, so I see a chemistry fit there. They've already established it.
Yeah.
And I think where Carolina's picking, you can't go wrong, whether it's Tkachuk or Zadina or Svechnikov, whoever's available at that spot.
Yep.
But I think that's a kind of a neat tiebreaker, that chemistry factor.
Zadina or Svechnikov?
I like Svechnikov.
Zadina or Svechnikov?
I'm a Zadina guy.
Ken Campbell somewhere off in the ether is saying, Brady Tkachuk!
He would.
That's how Ken talks.
Or Ken would have an even hotter take. He'd be like, Merkley at second overall.
No, he loves Tkachuk.
I love Tkachuk too.
Yeah. Tom Zoltowski asks, which college hockey coaches are most likely to be the NHL in the next year or so? And I think the reason he's asking this is because we've had two college coaches hired already this year, which is a bit of a trend because it's unusual.
Yeah,
To see guys jumping right from the NCAA into the NHL.
Yeah, you have David Quinn in New York and Jim Montgomery in Dallas, and this falls on the heels of Dave Haxtell in Philly not too long prior to that. I would say that the next option would be Scott Sandelin from Minnesota Duluth. Mm-hmm. This is a guy that has built up a program into a powerhouse, really. He's got two national titles already in, I believe, 8 seasons. And you know what? He's a developer. He's really good with defensemen. He was a defenseman himself. A couple of guys on his staff played defense at the pro level. So I would say that would be the most likely candidate for me right now.
Are you at all surprised that this has taken this long to take hold with how young the game is skewing? Mm-hmm. So don't you want guys who are used to playing, coaching younger players as your bench boss?
I think it's fair. I mean, maybe part of the reason why it took a while for GMs and owners to wake up is because I see there being a correlation with the rise of the analytics era, where you can no longer just make the argument based on eye test. Well, no, this old guy's better. Well, actually, no. According to these numbers, these Corsi numbers, this young guy is actually outperforming him even on a defensive level. So now that there's that extra validity given to young players, not just in terms of their obvious traits like speed, but even the fact that a young player can now be good defensively and responsible and kill penalties, I think that opened the door to a shift in philosophy where now it's like, okay, maybe you do want a coach that can handle young minds. And I think the Rangers are a great example because Alain Vigneault was known as the exact opposite type of coach. He was the veteran guy, always deferred to the older players. And that's a crazy shift in philosophy for that one team.
And I thought you had an interesting point, Ryan, that you made about when it comes to free agency, these guys are recruiters.
It's true.
So that's an added benefit you get with some of these coaches.
Yeah, they certainly know how to sell a program. They know the whole process. And you know, it's interesting that another person, not necessarily in coaching, but Steve Greeley, who was with Boston University, was a fantastic recruiter. He's now he's been with two NHL organizations now. I believe now he's with the Sabres. He was with the Rangers. He's kind of working his way up the ladder, and he came from a college background, or at least he came from BU before he went to the NHL, because he had that nice recruiting background. And yeah, you got to be able to relate to players these days, and you got to put on the sell as to why your NHL franchise should be the destination. Right. And it's exciting.
And just quickly before we go, tell listeners the David Carl story, because I think that's a really great story, and congratulations for him for getting the BU job.
Yeah, something I blogged about last week. David Carl is the new head coach of the Denver Pioneers, taking over for Jim Montgomery. David Carl, 10 years ago, was at the draft combine, played for Shattuck St. Mary's, was supposed to be probably a second or third round pick. They discovered a heart condition, which meant he had to retire right away. He kept his scholarship with Denver. They honored it. He became a student coach for 4 years. Then he went to the USHL for a bit, came back to Denver as an assistant coach, worked under Jim Montgomery, and he's still only 28 years old. And he was a great recruiter for them, a big reason why Henrik Borgstrom, the Florida Panthers first rounder, went to Denver, helped them win a national championship. Now David Carl has a chance to start something of his own with Jim Montgomery, leaving him a nice legacy. And it's just a great, fun story. It's Matt Carl's younger brother, the former NHL defenseman. And an exciting time.
Yeah, it's a heck of a story, of which you can read it full at thehockeynews.com. Of course, you can get daily updates from the Stanley Cup and the World of Prospects and all things hockey on our website. And we'll be back next week with another edition of the podcast. Enjoy the games, folks. For Matt Larkin and Ryan Kennedy, I'm Edward Fraser. Thanks for listening.